Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Robert Walker, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and Executive Director of the Frank H. and Evan B. Buck Foundation, and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers, Paul Bress, President of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Hal Harvey, CEO of Climate Works Foundation, who together have written a new book entitled Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy. Let me tell you a bit more about each of our speakers. As president of the Hewlett Foundation, Paul Bress oversees one of the largest foundations in the United States, with assets of over $6 billion and $785 million in grants awarded in 2008. Prior to devoting his full time to philanthropy, his career was in the law. A graduate of Harvard Law School, he served as law clerk to Supreme Court Justice John M. Harlan and practiced with the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. 40 years ago, he joined the faculty of Stanford Law School, where his research and teaching focused on constitutional law and problem-solving, decision-making. He served as dean of the law school from 1987 to 1999. He holds several honorary degrees and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Board of Trustees of Caltech. His avocations include playing chamber music and racquetball. Hal Harvey, a Stanford graduate in engineering, is the CEO of Climate Works Foundation, a global family of organizations that works in nations and economic sectors with the highest greenhouse gas emissions. Their work focuses on enacting policies that reduce these emissions through three general policy areas: energy efficiency standards, low carbon energy supply, and forest conservation and agriculture. From 1990 through 2002, he was the founder and president of the Energy Foundation, a joint initiative of six large United States foundations. And in 2001, he joined the Hewlett Foundation and served as their environment program director through 2008. Mr. Harvey served on energy panels appointed by Presidents Bush 41 and Clinton, and has published two books and dozens of articles on energy and national security issues. Among his other activities, he serves on the board of the Joyce Mertz Gilmore Foundation, the New Land Foundation, and the MB Financial Bank in Chicago. Now, please welcome Paul Bress, who will then be followed by Hal Harvey.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here this evening. The book that Hal and I have written, Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy, can be thought of as a self-improvement book, but a self-improvement book for the very rich. If it were sold at airport bookstores, which we certainly wish it would be at the executive jet terminal, probably. So passion plays an essential role in motivating a philanthropist to pursue particular goals. But once you've chosen a goal, then philanthropy is about choosing and implementing the best strategies to achieve it. You can think of a philanthropic goal and achieving it as a destination and getting to the destination as efficiently as possible. There's an old slogan from Cunard Lines in the days when they sailed across the Atlantic regularly, which was getting there is half the fun. That's actually not the way we think about philanthropy. Mm-hmm. Getting there should be fun, but what really matters is getting there. It really matters getting to your destination. The journey needs to be interesting because what motivates not just philanthropists, but most importantly the nonprofits that we support, is the passion that keeps them going. But ultimately, it's where they're going that matters. The fundamental idea of strategic philanthropy is to use whatever resources you have, however large or small they may be, to have maximum impact, to make the most difference in changing the world according to your lights. And strategic philanthropy, as such, doesn't favor particular ends. You know, when I think about the number of philanthropists I've met, and some of you in this room, I expect you may support scholarships for students in Central California, or climate change, or work with disadvantaged youth, or arts and culture. Those are all goals that precede strategic philanthropy. In fact, you know, it doesn't happen very often, I would say, that most of the goals that most philanthropists pursue are not at odds with each other, but they can be. You can be strategic being on the pro-choice side of the abortion issue, or you can be strategic as a philanthropist supporting nonprofits on the anti-side. To use an example very close to home, there were philanthropists and nonprofits on both sides of Proposition 8. What the tenets that I'll come to in a moment, which I think are the fundamental principles of strategic philanthropy, don't select particular goals over others. They basically suggest ways of whatever your goal is, be as clear and be as resourceful in achieving it. So what are the tenets? One is a problem-solving orientation. You can think of almost anything you're trying to change in the world as an opportunity, but it's also, you know, the flip side of an opportunity is a problem. There are barriers to achieving it because if there were no barriers, we would already solve the problem. So thinking about what the barriers are and how you're going to accomplish them. Second is clear goals. It's one thing to say, I want to make the world a better place for kids who've just been emancipated from foster care. It's another thing to specify just what you mean by that and how you're going to do it. In fact, something that Hal and I have found very useful in our own work, and it's reflected in the book, is there's no better way to clarify your goals than specifying targets. Rather than saying we would like to improve educational outcomes for disadvantaged kids in East Palo Alto, say by right now in 2009, 40% of the kids in fifth grade read at fifth grade levels. By 2011, we want 60% of the kids to read at fifth grade level. That is, set yourself some targets. It has the advantage of holding you and your grantees accountable to accomplish something, and the reason you choose 60% rather than 100% is you want it to be realistic. But it also has the wonderful advantage of clarifying what your goal is once you set a target. So you have a goal, you have a target. The next thing is a logical strategy for how you and your grantees, the nonprofits you support, can achieve those goals. And philanthropists sometimes talk about a logic model. The term actually comes from USAID, I think, originally. But the idea is that if you have a goal, there is a series of steps, logical steps, you hope, at least not illogical steps for accomplishing it. And that unless you go through the steps in the logic model, the chances are you are not going to accomplish it. So that if, for example, you're trying to improve educational outcomes in East Palo Alto and you're using a system, a theory that, which is sometimes called adaptive learning, where each teacher designs a curriculum for each student, sees how the student is doing, and then adapts what he or she is teaching the student accordingly, then you kind of think of steps. Well, the teacher needs to think about what each student's needs are. That's step one. Needs to get feedback from the student. That's step two. Needs to readjust the teaching based on that feedback, and so on and so forth. This is called a logic model because, you know, it's fundamentally, it's a linear model. You know, life is more complicated than a linear model, but you can usually describe at least the basics of what you're doing in a linear way. It's not enough that it be logical. It ultimately has to be empirically based, right? It's because anything you do in philanthropy is based on a theory about how the world works. Sometimes it's really complicated, as Hal's work and climate work suggests. It depends on complicated atmospheric chemistry, and then it depends on a theory of how you actually create policy change, and maybe Hal will talk about that. If not in his talk in the Q&A, he certainly would. If your theory of atmospheric chemistry is wrong, then all the money poured into your strategy is not going to work. There was, and theories sometimes seem right, intuitively, and they turn out to be wrong ultimately. There are so many, especially in the world of social change, there are so many things that seem right. A drug enforcement program which is designed to scare children. Well, it turns out that once evaluations were done of those programs, the effects were, if not, sometimes they were actually counterproductive, but they didn't work. An example, until maybe 10 years ago or so, you could put your bet, if you were trying to reduce teen pregnancy, you could put your bet on an abstinence-only program or a program that included abstinence counseling for teens with comprehensive sex education. And then Congress funded some really good empirical studies, and it shows that the abstinence-only programs don't work. The issue here for me is not, you know, one program versus another. It's that, you know, you could put all the money in the world into a program, but if the empirical side is wrong, it's not going to work. So the theory of change has to be not just logical, it has to be empirically correct. You need to do due diligence on grantees, because you can have the best theory in the world and the best logic model, but if the grantee organization doesn't have the capacity to carry it out, then it's not going to work. That may seem obvious. You also need to have sufficient resources to tackle the problem you are addressing. And sometimes, you know, one foundation alone, one philanthropist alone, can't do very much, unless it's the Gates Foundation, I suppose. But you can aggregate your resources with others and accomplish a huge amount. But you need to know that your resources aggregated with others is going to do the job within whatever period of time you think is reasonable. And you need feedback. I think the weakest link of philanthropy these days, forever actually, is the absence of systematic feedback on how you're doing. To go back to the voyage metaphor, imagine journeying across the ocean with simply a compass and dead reckoning, without a sextant, without a ship's chronometer. Today, with you have GPS also. You know, you're going to be off course very soon, and social change is much harder than navigating across an ocean. And the last thing I want to talk about is taking appropriate risk. We don't talk, until recently there hasn't been much talk about risk-taking in philanthropy. And yet, most ambitious philanthropy has a very good chance of failing. The work that Hal is doing with the support of the Hewlett Foundation, the Packard and McKnight Foundations and others in trying to keep the temperature of the Earth from rising more than 2 degrees over the next 10 or so years, the chances of that actually happening may not be very great. What makes it worthwhile is the extraordinary impact that philanthropy can have if we keep it from happening. Or to put it differently, the terrible state we will be in if we don't. So you need to understand what the risks are in order to mitigate them, in order to try to take whatever measures you can against the risks eventuating. You also need to be realistic about failure. Failure is almost a dirty word in the philanthropic and nonprofit sectors. And yet if you look at the venture capitalists who live across the road from the Hewlett Foundation, many of their ventures fail. It's only by understanding failure and learning from it that you can then pick up and do things better. And finally, different philanthropists have different tolerances for risk. There's some individuals who are willing to bet the farm on climate change, and there are others who would like to have safer philanthropic objectives. Hal will talk about that. So second to last thing I want to talk about is not only doesn't strategic philanthropy disfavor or favor particular ends, it doesn't have a preference for particular means. It's whatever works. Sometimes it's direct services, providing, you know, schooling or after school for kids. Sometimes it's research. Sometimes it's advocacy. Sometimes it's demonstration projects, although with demonstration projects, you need to have some reason to think that if it's successful, somebody's going to take it up. Let me just mention, in case we don't have enough questions, 4 things that I think critics don't like about strategic philanthropy. One is that it's all metrics and no passion. Another is that it doesn't support really transformative goals like civil rights movements. Another is that it doesn't value institutions and institution building as much as it should. And finally, that philanthropists who have their own theories of change and their own logic models impose these on operating nonprofit organizations. I think there are reasonable answers to all of those, but we'll leave it to you to decide whether you want to raise the questions. And I now turn the podium over to Hal.
Just wanted to remind you, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests are Paul Bress, president of the Hewlett Foundation, and Hal Harvey, CEO of Climate Works Foundation, who are discussing strategic philanthropy, strategies that catalyze change to benefit the world.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Paul. It's great to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I will try to be quick. I've got to explain a diagram that the people in the audience can see, but the folks on the radio cannot, so I'll explain it carefully as I go. Paul talked about strategic philanthropy as the discipline of strategic philanthropy is not dependent on a specific subject. But, of course, the first and in some ways the most important thing philanthropists will do is choose a subject in which to work or more than one. And we spent a lot of time talking about this and arguing this as we wrote the book to try to understand whether these very choices affect the way you structure your philanthropy. And I'm here to present an argument that they do indeed. The book, as Paul said, doesn't recommend that you should fund in the arts or fund in the prevention of nuclear war or do cancer research, but suggests that depending on what kinds of what subjects you choose, you will land on certain types of philanthropy. The choice of subject drives, in many ways, what you can do well or what you must do well in order to succeed. What I want to argue today is that there are three axes on which to consider your choices, and I'm going to bundle them together. The first is scale. Does the problem that you're working on or the solution that you propose just affect your local community, or does it affect the entire state of California, or is it a global problem? And that's this horizontal axis here. It goes from blue to red on the right, small scale to large scale. If you want to build a new gym for your high school, then the scale is obviously the high school. And the people that it affects are going to be the kids in that school. And you're going to see the benefit right when you build it. If you're concerned about the environment the way my mother was or is, you might want to invest, as she has, in protecting national forests. A national forest might have several hundred thousand acres in it. It's governed by a federal agency, the Department of Agriculture, as it happens. It goes through a planning process which determines the future of that forest. If you make smart investments in investigating the biology and the tourism and the usage of that forest and get it presented in an intelligent way to the Department of Agriculture or the National Forest Service, you will have a profound impact on the future of that forest, and maybe some of it will become designated as wilderness. So that's a regional focus, and if you focus on that, you can make a big difference. We recently obviously had the swine flu scare, and that's a pandemic. The scale of that is global by definition of a pandemic, and there are philanthropists who focus on that large scale. So that's the first axis to consider. The second axis, which is the vertical one on this chart, is a time scale. Is a problem reversible or is it irreversible? Some things are reversible in days or even weeks. If you don't put on a symphony, then there will be disappointed people or there will be a certain cultural richness lost, but it's possible to put on a symphony in another week or another month or another year. If we don't control acid rain this year, we might lose a generation or two of environmental viability of the lakes and the Adirondacks, which, in fact, we did. But they came back when we finally learned to control acid rain. If you let a species get driven to extinction, that's obviously irreversible. So that's the top of that axis. There are some choices about which, if you get it wrong, they're irreversible for all time. And the third axis we've got, which is this one coming off here, it's the third dimension of this cube, is does the problem and the solution affect the quality of life or does it affect the very viability of life? What affects the quality of life? If you have a local garden program, for example, you're going to get kids in the community growing things, and they're going to be a little bit happier or maybe a lot happier and healthier, and there's going to be a community spirit. It affects the quality of the life of everybody who participates. Something like air pollution is in between. It's unpleasant. It affects the quality of life to breathe dirty air. If you're asthmatic, it affects whether you get to live or not. And there are a lot of people in America and a lot more in China who die every year because the air quality is bad. And at the extreme end of that scale is nuclear war, for example, right? Or a pandemic again. It affects whether you get to live or not. When you put these all together, some very interesting things start to appear. Let me start with that little cube down here, which is the stuff that's local, that has short time scales, and that affects the quality of life. And I'll go back to the example I said before of a community garden. When you invest in stuff in that cube, it has the following characteristics. You see the benefits very quickly. You put the dollar in, you get the result out. The logic model typically is you buy the service, right? If you want to support a local concert, you put some money in, you get the concert out. If you want to support the local Boys and Girls Club, you put the money in, you get the support out. The feedback for a philanthropist is immediate. It's tangible. It's gratifying. You can go watch the smiles on the kids' faces or see the audience light up at a play. You've tangibly affected the quality of life. There's also psychic feedback because everybody knows you contributed. Your name's on the program. You get honored at the tables and so on. The consequence of those kinds of feedback and the certainty of your logic model is that that's where most philanthropy lands. People support stuff they know. They support stuff that gives them immediate feedback and where they can see the result. Let me go to the other extreme edge of the cube where the scale is large, where the time scales are irreversible, and where the issues threaten life itself. One of them is an area where I work. Climate change. Obviously, global climate change, the scale, we can figure that one out. The time scales are essentially irreversible. I mean, it might reverse in millions of years, but it's certainly not going to reverse in less than millions of years. And threatens life itself. For some people, it is a quality of life issue, but if you happen to live in Bangladesh, it's not a quality of life issue. It's a whether you live or not issue. Or if you look at global agricultural productivity projected to drop by 40% in this century, that's a viability of life issue. So that's the extreme edge of that cube. What are the characteristics of stuff at the extreme edge of that cube? In order to win that problem, you need incredible leverage. I can't go spend $1 million on new light bulbs and move the carbon needle. I can spend $1 million affecting the public utility regulations in California, which then incentivizes the utilities to spend $1 billion on new light bulbs, and I've got 1,000-to-1 leverage. And that starts to make sense. And if you add up that math across more sectors and more countries and more parts of the world, you can begin to envision a solution to the problem. So at the outer edges of the cube, you need scale. You have to have leverage. That implies an excellent logic model, as Paul suggests. I can't just put money out randomly. I have to think very carefully about where that money should land in order to make a difference. It implies a high tolerance for risk because you are going to fail. If you think you can reliably deliver 1,000-to-1 or 10,000-to-1 leverage, then you're a fool, or else you have my job, or both. So there's model complexity. There's logic model complexity. There's lots of risk. A third element is time scales. It takes a while to see the impact you make. If I buy that gym for that high school, I can see the kids playing in it the next year. If I invest in Chinese automobile fuel efficiency standards, and I'm lucky enough to see them increase the fuel efficiency of their cars, and I'm patient enough to do the math and figure out how much less carbon dioxide that will have, and I'm around in 150 years, and I have a really, really good sense of measurement, maybe I can see the floods in Bangladesh rise a little bit less, right? So you have to have a tolerance for abstraction. You have to have patience that extends beyond your own life. And you have to have this complex logic model, and, of course, you have to have some risk. The reward for taking all those risks and having all that complexity is leverage. You can have a profound impact with a modest amount of money. There's one other cost, by the way, to getting out on the outer edge of the cube, which is you typically don't get the psychic and social feedback that you get from investing locally. There will never be a plaque for the ClimateWorks Foundation on that beach in Bangladesh, right? That says you saved this acre. When you know, philanthropy means love of humanity. It doesn't mean thinking about humanity. I don't know what that word would be. If you're going to get out on the outer edge of the cube where things have a lot of leverage, you have to be willing to suspend some of the emotions, or I shouldn't say suspend them, but you have to at least temper them with this logical intensity and a real sense of discipline in order to get that. You have to be comfortable with risk and with long time constants. It's a completely different style of philanthropy. Last thing I want to say is, if you want to go out there, and you don't have to go all the way to climate change, there's a lot of stuff, there are many important steps along the way. On any of these axes, by the way, you can mention any program, and it's not hard to locate it in that cube. You don't need vast amounts of money to affect hard problems, as long as you're sensible about where the money should land. And I'm going to mention the Plowshares Fund briefly, which is a fund that specializes in the prevention of nuclear arms control. That's also at the outer edge of the box, right? Long time constants, like it's irreversible if you blow up the world. Large scale, it is the world, and threatens life itself. Check. The Plowshares Fund started with about $1 million a year. It's probably 10 times that large. It's a fairly small number compared to the defense budget, for example. But the Plowshares Fund knows its audience extremely well. It understands the nuclear priesthood. It understands how nuclear strategy is set. It understands the proliferation problem and who the actors are. It knows very well the small number of nonprofits engaged in this and the small number of actors involved in this. And they have made grants, $20,000, to send a former Secretary of Defense to North Korea for quiet negotiations that one can make a fair case, dialed back a war between North Korea and South Korea a while ago, or a wider one at that. They made a small number of grants that created the National Treaty Against Landmines, which almost every nation in the world has signed, for a few $100,000. And so even in these tough problems, small focused donations can make an enormous case, but you have to be quite disciplined and you have to understand your systems very well. Last thing I'll say is, one way you can work in a tough problem with a modest amount of money is to hook up with other partners who have their own logic models, who have their own entree, who understand their venues, and as you do as well, specialize a little bit, and then get in there, and you'll see some interesting things happen. So, thank you.
Our thanks to Paul Bress, president of the Hewlett Foundation, and Hal Harvey, CEO of ClimateWorks Foundation, who together have written a new book entitled Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy. It's time now for our audience question period, and we have a number of them. Questions around strategy, questions around the economic downturn seem to be the most on people's minds. So we'll start with ones on strategy. What are the most important steps for fundraisers to take if they are trying to move or help donors to be more strategic?
I'll begin, and I would say that it is clarity of what somebody's goals are. Now, a fundraiser for a nonprofit may not always want the donor to have clarity about his or her goals, because the fundraiser wants the clarity to be around whatever the organization's goals are. So there may be a little bit of a tension there, but strategy, the whole idea of strategy is getting somewhere. And if you're not clear, as the old saying goes, you know, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And any strategy will get you there, too.
No, I would agree, but let me add one more shade to this. In almost every problem, there is a decision maker who enables your solution or doesn't enable your solution. If you can identify that decision maker by name or certainly by function, maybe it's a school board. Maybe it's a member of Congress. Maybe it's the Assistant Secretary of the Interior. Maybe it's the CEO of a corporation. If you can identify the decision maker, understand well the venue in which he or she operates, and demonstrate that you have some influence over that decision maker, then you have mastered your venue, and then your fundraising is far easy, because you're demonstrating the difference between trying and achieving. And when you're in the philanthropy business, that's magic.
Great. Question, how do externalities like the Recovery Act funding dollars affect your strategies when there is overlap in goals? Do you work closely with organizations like DOE, CEC, and others, or pull back into niches not being targeted by the government?
Well, that's such a timely – well, it's intended to be a timely question. I think Hal mentioned that the mantra of strategic philanthropy is expected return. That is, given your goals, where can you get the most bang for the buck? And sometimes it is sticking with long-term projects, even when there are short-term needs and opportunities. But sometimes something comes up that makes you say it's you know, not time to change our goals, but time to change our strategies. So a specific example from the Hewlett Foundation is, some of you may know, the Department of Education has the most amount that it's ever had in its history to spend through the stimulus funds. Our board has approved of a substantial set of amount for grants to help school districts use the stimulus funds wisely. This is an opportunity which, if it goes by, many school districts will use the money in ways that will have no lasting impact, and if it's used strategically, could actually transform some school districts. So I think one should you never lose sight of your goals, but you also need to be reasonably opportunistic.
Specific question here about what steps do you recommend for a reading specialist who has discovered the cause of dyslexia and how to avoid it?
Well, I would ask, first one needs to parse that question, has discovered the cause of dyslexia, and make sure you really understand that you have discovered the cause. And I would go to the challenge that Paul put out at the beginning. You need to rely on evidence. You need to understand evidence. And the difference between a plausible theory and an idea backed by evidence is a vast difference indeed. And most proposals are more about the former than about the latter. And again, how should fundraisers be successful? Know the latter. So the first thing I would say is make sure your evidence is sound. Presuming your evidence is sound, then ask yourself, who's the decision maker that's going to affect this? Is it the way you raise children? Is it the medicines they get? Is it genetic screening? I don't know what the solution is, but whatever it is, there's a decision maker who gets to decide to make that thing happen or not make that thing happen. And then do some sociological and cost-effectiveness calculations about how do you reach that decision maker. Again, if maybe it's mothers that need to be educated or fathers, you have to find out what do they read? What are they paying attention to? And try to become relevant in those realms.
Do you think your strategy would work for public K through 12 schools as well?
If a strategy won't work for K through 12 education, then we are doomed, because the way you go about education, educational theories, is going to make all the difference in the success of our school system, and it has. I'll give you an example, actually using not public schools but some charter schools. So the KIPP programs, a charter school system, began with some social entrepreneurs' guess about what would work, and that if you had fairly disciplined school days and much longer school days and school years than most public schools had, you could really change the lives of disadvantaged kids. And they pursued that strategy. They got feedback on what worked and what didn't. They did evaluation. And over time, you know, while it's by no means perfected, it has been honed to a point where it really makes a difference. On the other hand, there are lots of charter schools and public schools where you just throw kids in for the day, and they have no effect. So strategy makes all the difference in education. I think there's no area where strategy doesn't make a difference.
Question about benefits. What benefits are most important to philanthropists? For example, name on building, listing on the web pages, attendance at organizations, functions, award dinners, et cetera, special events?
So I would like to hope the answer is none of the above.
None of the above.
Yeah. But 49 out of the largest 50 foundations in this country are named after their founders. So maybe it's some of the above. I think the more time you spend in this business, the less you care about being feted and the more you care about real-world difference in people's lives. But that does take time. And And philanthropy begins for many people as a sense of social obligation. It continues for many as a sense of social belonging or social function. And when it's in those realms, recognition is very nice. But as philanthropy graduates into a very deep concern about problems and a very disciplined approach to solving those problems, I think you forget about the name on the program.
Right. Knowledge management seems to be a key to avoiding failed efforts. How can foundations take advantage of the knowledge and lessons learned in the field?
It's an area that foundations have not been very good at. The complaint has sometimes been that foundations don't share the knowledge they have with others, but I think the problem is more deeply rooted. It's that foundations don't systematically capture the knowledge they have. So when a program officer leaves, whatever local knowledge he or she had about grantees or about strategies that work or not, leave with her. And I think we're beginning to turn that around. We're beginning to understand that knowledge is a really important asset that foundations have. Sometimes colleagues say that knowledge and our power to convene are the most important assets we have. And you have to remind them that nobody would pay attention to our knowledge or our attempt to convene if we didn't also have money. But they are important assets as well.
We have two questions for Paul here. What is the state of the art today in performance evaluation of NGOs and nonprofits?
Well, this is a question which I'll say a word, but I think Hal needs to answer this also because he's actually pushing in Climate Works the state of the art on evaluation. I think that a good turn in philanthropy has been to move from evaluating process and only evaluating process to evaluating outcomes. Again, it's the destination that matters, not whether you had a smooth voyage getting there, although if the voyage is too choppy, you may not get there. And I think there's been a turn in philanthropy to recognizing the ability of real strong outcome evaluation. Ideally, when you can do it, randomized controlled studies, there's much more of that than there used to be. But then using quasi-experimental designs, econometric means and others. But let me turn to Hal, who, because Climate Works from its beginning has been a fiend on evaluation.
Well, thanks, Paul. We actually developed a tool we use for strategy setting and use the exact same tool for evaluation. And it starts out with a very simple pair of questions. The first is, how many tons of carbon dioxide emissions or global warming pollution would this strategy avoid if you're successful? Give us a number. Don't give me a heartbreaking case about it. Just give me a number, one number. And second, what's the probability that the political leaders, because these are all policy changes, that the political leaders in charge of this, what's the probability that they're going to enact this policy if you spend the money and work hard on this thing? And then we ask them to expound a little bit on the probability question and make their case. Again, it's what's the venue? Why do you think you're going to be relevant? Why should they listen to you? What are the economics of the case? Who's against it? How badly are they going to beat you up? This is not a long and complicated thing, but it has to be done very well in order to succeed. Connected with all of this is an evaluation component. And at 12-month clock, everybody who's done one of these also has to go back and say, how's it going? Did we win? That's terrific. Usually you don't win in 1 year. What kind of progress have you made and how have you made it? And what you do not get to put in there is we held this many meetings and we published this many things on the web and we walked the block and so on. We're not interested in that at all. Unless what we're interested in is was the decision maker influenced? If so, how do you know? How was he or she influenced? And what did you have to do with it? And given that, what's the next iteration for you? So I think the first part of evaluation is stating the case clearly. If the case I make is, I'm really worried about this problem, then evaluation's impossible because you're still worried a year later, I guess. That's your proof of success. If the case is as specific as, you know, maybe a school reform, that the school board will adjust teaching hours in this district, then at the end of the year, you know if you made it or not.
Right. This question is also addressed to Paul, but Hal, you can address it as well. How would you apply the concept of strategic philanthropy as an agent of change to culture and the arts?
I think that within the foundation, the Hewlett Foundation supports performing arts as a separate program at the same time as we support dealing with some of the most difficult problems in the world, like climate change, like public education. I think that it begins once again with clarity about what the goals in performing arts are. You know, and our program, where you can have multiple goals as long as you're clear what they are and as long as you then have strategies that are designed to meet them. So we're interested in the quality of music, theater, and dance in the Bay Area. We're interested in the diversity of cultures that are represented. We're interested in the diversity of communities that are able to attend. And we don't have sharp metrics for each of these. We don't say, you know, this organization, you know, has 30% of this and 20% of that. But when you look at the whole ecosystem, which is the way we think about the work in the same way that Hal thinks about climate ecosystems, you know whether there are gaps in coverage in the Bay Area, and you also know how organizations are doing. Hal, you might want to talk about this as well.
No, I'm a Philistine, Paul, so I will.
No comments. In your book, you mentioned the website smartphilanthropy.org several times. What are your plans and hopes for that website?
Well, I would hope it continues to be, and in fact considerably grows, as a venue for the kind of give and take that we're having this evening. The world of philanthropy has a problem that people don't like to talk about too much, which is all the feedback you get is positive feedback. If you're running a foundation, you don't have to get elected. You don't have to show a profit at the end of the year. All the newspaper coverage is going to be nice because you give away money. And everybody who visits you is going to act like you walk on water. And so if you live in that environment for too long, you start to believe it. And that's very dangerous because chances are you won't be doing the best job you could be doing if all you're getting is positive feedback. My hope with this website is that we can have a vigorous conversation about what works, what doesn't, and that it's not a cringe about failure. There's no way you're going to have large-scale success unless you have some pretty significant failures along the way. So it kind of opens up the space a little.
The question does remind me that we haven't been keeping it up all that much lately. And based on the question, I'll come back. Look at it a week from now. There'll be some more
From your perspective, where are the areas where there is a lack of knowledge and there could be interesting places for foundation R&D?
I would start with global security issues. Sounds big, sounds complicated, but like many fields, if you delve in and spend a little time, you can get to know the subjects and the actors and the venues relatively quickly. And I mentioned the Plowshares example. The same goes for a lot of regional conflicts and for political crises that are especially dangerous. It's amazing how a calm, dispassionate injection of intelligence, of reasoned diplomacy, sometimes by outside actors, can make a huge difference. It's also amazing to me how very little funds is available for that sort of thing. Governments are interested parties. They don't always have the credibility or the stature or the positioning to go do that kind of thing. And most philanthropists don't work in this field, so I think that's a realm that's ripe for address.
Several questions about the downturn in the economy and all that. Strategic philanthropy is about making the world a better place. With foundation assets having dropped 22% last year and close to two-thirds of the foundations expecting to reduce the number and or size of the grants they award in 2009, according to the Foundation Center, what areas do you think will be most impacted?
I'm not going to answer that question directly, at least not yet, but rather talk about how foundations can go about thinking about reducing grants budgets, whether they should reduce grants budgets at all, because I think the answer to the question is going to depend very much on different philanthropists with different interests. I mean, one assumption which I think has happily been challenged more in the last year than I've heard it ever challenged before is whether foundations should assume that they exist in perpetuity. Some are set up to exist in perpetuity either by the founder's wish or by strong traditions. The Hewlett Foundation is an example of that. But there are many foundations that aren't. And there's a really interesting question: should you spend the money now? Can you make the best use of the money now, or are you best off letting future generations of trustees or family members spend it in the future? We have a chapter of the book that addresses the pros and cons of that, but I think that people are giving it much more thought as they see the possibilities for very useful expenditures right now. A second point, independent of that, is, as Hal mentioned, different philanthropists find themselves in different parts of this cube. And if you've committed yourself to long-term problem solving, whether it's climate change, trying to avert or prepare for pandemics, or nuclear war, those problems are going to exist after the recession is over. You know, whether the recession takes 1 or 5 years to be over, we're going to have those problems on our hands. And I think that for the relatively few philanthropists who've really dedicated themselves to work on the outer edges of the cube, this is the time to stay the course and let others deal with the wrenching immediate problems that there exist.
Yeah, let me add a related perspective. If you think about the way nonprofit groups evolve, they're usually founded because somebody has an idea or a passion or both, ideally both. And that somebody builds a small project and calls some friends and raises a little money, and maybe it's successful, and then they iterate and they get a couple staff and they learn how to fundraise and they get a couple of grants and so on. So there's this nucleation point, and out of it grows a nonprofit, and it might be a homeless shelter or environmental organization or who knows. Over time, even these little things become very, very big and established. And that's all wonderful. There's a democracy, there's passion, everything's going on. But if you look at the system that creates, you don't necessarily have an efficient way to deal with every problem. And I'll mention environmental groups. I worked in the environmental field in the West for many years. And most of those happy nucleation points were in Boulder, Colorado, or Bozeman, Montana, or San Francisco, which is great. But there's a lot of environment in between those three parts of the West that's important. There's Utah and Arizona and New Mexico, for example. And so when you hit adversity, you have to look hard at the ecosystem and say what's absolutely crucial and what's getting done. You at the same time have to ask who's a great performer and who's a marginal performer. And it might be time for a little bit of consolidation. It might be time for a little bit of refocusing. And I don't think we should shy away from that just because it's a nonprofit field. In fact, I would argue that the public custodian responsibilities are even sharper in the nonprofit field because the funds are so scarce. So we have to be willing to chase down and either repair or stop funding marginally performing organizations.
With the economic downturn, do you see foundations making changes in investment strategies or operating expenses?
I think that a number of foundations have become more cautious in their investment strategies because foundations depend on, again, the ones that are relying on an endowment to generate income. Because they're depending on the income, we can't go to cash. And we're making the bet that over a period of time, the markets will come back. Today was a nice example, but who knows what's going to happen tomorrow.
What impact is this economy having on volunteerism, and do you think that's affecting philanthropy?
I've only heard anecdotes, but I gather it's up. Volunteerism is up. People still want productive things, even if they're out of work. And there's a sense when a community in crisis, the people should step up. And I think one of the silver linings of this might be a bolstered sense of community and an increased volunteerism. And I actually predict that when it starts with an individual, it keeps going.
Question about foundation support. Do foundations ever support individuals who don't have a board behind them, an individual who has come up with a valid solution to a national problem?
Foundations can support individuals, but it requires a program that is approved by the Internal Revenue Service in order to do it. So a foundation like the Hewlett Foundation is not set up, for example, even to do scholarships, which I know, Bob, your foundation can do. Foundations also are committed, if they're going to use their tax deductible resources, to making grants for a charitable purpose. That doesn't mean that we can only make grants to 501c3 charities, but it does limit what we can do for individuals.
Question about collaboration. What is your best collaborative strategic relationship at the moment?
Well, we are ourselves a collaboration of a number of foundations, three large ones that have founded ClimateWorks, plus a couple dozen more that support our network partners. And it's a little bit complicated pulling a collaboration together and making it successful. I think it's well worthwhile if people are very clear about why they want to do it, what they expect out of it, and how it operates. And there are many ways it can fall apart. I actually am not one who believes in collaboration for collaboration's sake. I always argue that you should have the FedEx rule when you collaborate with somebody, which is to say, I like to give FedEx $12 to fly my packages across the world because I don't want to buy an airplane, and they already have some. And so there's huge mutual advantage for me using Federal Express. We need to look for those areas of mutual advantage. And if they're not there, stand back, because you're going to spend the rest of your life on conference calls to no specific end. If you really want to collaborate, you need to have some sober conversations about, are your goals really aligned? Do you have complementary strengths? Is there an advantage in scale? And how are you going to operate so that the transaction costs don't drag the whole thing down? There are a few more questions you have to ask yourself and try to answer them affirmatively. One is, let's say you do a collaborative grant-making program with three other foundations. Do your grantees benefit from the collaboration? Do they still have to slog into four different foundations, four different sets of timelines, four different sets of application guidelines, and so on? Or could you standardize a little bit and make it easy for them? Same with evaluation. Do you have to run through four evaluation processes? Even the time cycles of grants, one wants to think about that. Make sure there's value for your grantees in the collaboration. I would also say that when you collaborate, you need to suspend a little bit your own psychic gratification, because you're sharing ownership with other funders. And that's okay if the job's getting done, but you have to be willing to give up some credit to make it work well. That would be my...
And I'll just add a word. I mean, the fundamental question is this going to add value, right? It's not whether these are nice guys to work with. But something that I've learned for the Hewlett Foundation's collaboration is who you work with makes all the difference. That is, assuming you have a common project and a common goal, then there's some people who are very easy to work with and there's some people who are not. And usually, if the organization is internally dysfunctional, then they're bad collaborators. Are a number of our best collaborators, and so the question was what was an ongoing one, I'll mention one. A number of our best collaborations have been with the Irvine and Packard Foundations, and we have an ongoing one right now. The happy ending for us to what was a very sad or sour tale of AB 624, the attempt of the California legislature to regulate foundations' expenditure for minority-led groups. But these three foundations in Northern California and some others in Southern California, we've gotten together and are creating, we are making grants to strengthen minority-led organizations. We're creating a common format for applications, a common evaluation form. So for a grantee, instead of having to go to three different foundations, we've aggregated our funds to make it quite easy.
It's called aggregating the aggravation.
Question, what are the life-threatening global problems that philanthropy has a chance to address in the big cube?
All of them.
All of them.
Yeah. Let me start with the four. I mentioned climate change already. There, you know, if you're disciplined about your analysis on climate change, you begin to understand that a small number of policies in a small number of countries make an enormous difference. Focus your efforts on those. Be driven by the analytics and be driven by the venues. You can make an enormous difference with a modest amount of money. The world's population is going to increase by 50% in the next 50 years. And we are fundamentally not treating half of the existing 6 billion people very well. And by the way, most of the newcomers are going to land in relatively poor parts of the world. We need to think pretty hard about women's rights and women's education so that people have a fair choice. And the future of the population is perhaps a little more rational than maybe otherwise. I would argue species extinction is on the edge of that box. And species extinction, you slow down with climate change, of course, but habitat preservation. It's kind of time to stop building new roads across virgin territory in America and in a lot of other countries, I would argue. Again, that's highly susceptible to philanthropic intervention. Let me emphasize, though, this is not what our book is about, and I'm moving into my personal opinion here. The book argues about generic strategies for philanthropy, but I guess I would say that even on the edges of the cube, and pandemics might be another one, there are things with even modest amounts of money you can make an enormous difference.
One of the challenges to success in the nonprofit field is the focus on how much money is spent on things like overhead, admin costs, IT systems, and overall organizational capacity. Business focuses on results and return on investment and are not held prisoner to ratios such as those promoted by Charity Navigator. Do you foresee a way that we can move away from ratios and focus on results?
Well, I couldn't agree more with the implication of that question. Charity Navigator, for those of you who haven't seen it, is a web-based performance indicator for nonprofits, but it fundamentally looks at costs and not benefits. There's no attempt to find out whether an organization is having any impact, whether it's achieving results, only what its administrative or fundraising costs are. And that would be the equivalent in business of looking at the cost side and not finding out whether there are any revenues. For nonprofits, the revenues are not money. They are the social impact it has. I think there's a considerable movement. Whether it gains traction and the traction continues remains to be seen. To try to provide donors with real information about how organizations are doing. GuideStar is beginning to do that. There's some local efforts. There's a not exactly quantitative website, but a very helpful one called Greater Nonprofits, run by somebody who was at the business school at Stanford. So there's movement toward impact, but it's going to require ultimately a change in donor consciousness. The donors care. I mean, part of the theory of change of Hal's in my book is to try to change the consciousness of donors so that they not only care about but have the tools to do something about this. We would regard the book as a great success if it contributed just a little bit to the movement in that direction.
And just to add a little bit on that, the clearer you are about your goals and the more confident you have in your theory of change, the less you care about rent and overhead and so on. That's the last thing on your mind. But on the other hand, if you're fuzzy about it, if your goal is to help humanity, what are you going to measure? So you focus on the trivial.
Question about lobbying for you. Why should foundations and nonprofits be limited in their efforts to influence government officials and voters?
It's tax-advantaged money, and you know, half the money was put there by the donor, and in effect, half by the taxpayer. And we have a very special privilege and a very commensurate social obligation to spend that money wisely. And that means some things are out of bounds, and one of them is lobbying. And I'm quite comfortable with that line. I mean, there are times I chafe at it, as we all do. But I think if you essentially have taxpayer money being controlled by private individuals to lobby the laws directly, you have the potential of creating a vicious cycle with detrimental effects.
Question about international philanthropy. How is this economic downturn affecting international philanthropy, and what advice do you have for philanthropic organizations outside the United States?
Yeah, it's affecting it very, very severely. I mean, what it's affecting most severely, of course, is the well-being of people in developing countries who have been living on the edge, but living below the edge, and this pushes them down even further because the recession in the North has huge implications for the South. I don't know how it's affected individuals individual philanthropists giving. I just don't know that. I think those foundations that have been concerned with international issues, whether it's in development or the environment or other areas, I think that they have stayed the course. But inevitably, if you're not going to spend down, that means that your grants budget goes down. I think for many of us, for international as well as domestic giving, we've tried to create a safe landing or at least a glide path for our grantees. But it's gone down for international as well as domestic grantees.
A technical question here. Foundations seek measurable outcomes. Some outcomes will take 2 to 3 years, and grants are often given for 1 year. Thus, interim milestones are needed. But if the ultimate outcome sought is adoption of a new public policy, the interim measurable milestones may require changes in the public opinion that you'd measure by polling. Polling costs money. Will foundations fund expensive tools like polling?
The answer is absolutely, and the Hewlett Foundation, amongst others, has funded, for example, the Public Policy Institute of California to make sure there's a rich, rich body of public opinion to inform our work and the work of many others, including political leaders. However, you have to be intelligent about this, and you can't make the evaluation burden so heavy that the expenses of evaluation dwarf the program itself. So if you wanted to run a poll for every action you did, it'd be fairly extreme. But you raise there's a broader point embedded in there, which is if a foundation wants results and wants to understand how it's moving to results, it has to be willing to spend some money on R&D and some money on evaluation. The stuff doesn't come for free. It's well worth it if it gives you new guidance. If you know for whatever reason that an outcome's happening and you don't need to spend that money, fine. But most of us hope more than we know.
And 1 year grants are simply too short for anybody who's serious about working at least at the outer edges of the cube.
Yep.
Great. Well, we've come to the point in our program where there's time for only one more question, and so this is the last question. How often is a grant request decided by the heart versus the head? Are there times where logic needs to be overruled?
The very first time I met Paul, he was holding a mug that said, invest without emotion. So that's his answer. No, I look, one needs passion to get involved in this business. One needs some sympathy and sometimes some empathy to understand what groups are going through as they try to struggle with them. Certainly needs to be concerned with especially, for example, impoverished populations or people with diminished human rights, and so on. You can't take that out. On the other hand, you're going to do more for your heart if you pay attention to your head and if you're a little bit disciplined than if you don't. So let it be a motivating factor, but don't let it govern your core decisions.
Let me add to that. One advantage that foundations with staffs have over individual donors, and they have it over Hal and me when we're acting as individuals, is that they have programs with guidelines which the staff and board have worked on, and they're able, in a way, to follow those even when their hearts say, you know, let's forget about these and help the person who's just come in the door. And sure, there's always, as Hal said, there's always an important room for intuition, and the heart plays a role. But if you look at the immediate crises that happen, I'm not sure the best use of foundation money is after a Katrina or after a tsunami. I think that's where Hal and me and all of you as individuals can get out our pocketbooks. And fundamentally, I think foundations, especially those that are working on the outer edges of Hal's cube, should, rather than spend their money responding to Katrina, put their money in preventing the next one.
Great. Thank you very much. Our thanks to Paul Bress, President of the Hewlett Foundation, and Hal Harvey, CEO of ClimateWorks Foundation, who together have written a new book entitled Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy. We also thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the Internet. Remember, we encourage you to continue this conversation by joining us on the Internet at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I'm Robert Walker, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you and good evening. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.